Hello and welcome to the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, later at alexlinder.com. Follow me on gab.com. Today we're going to do a famous old tract called Might is Right. And we'll do it in probably 5, 6, 7, maybe 8 at most different segments. They won't last too awfully long. They all should be under an hour. So let's dig in. Today we'll do the prefatory material in Chapter 1 of Might is Right. I'll be doing it off of a PDF. I don't have an actual copy of it right now. Might is Right, or The Survival of the Fittest, by Ragnar Redbeard, R-A-G-N-A-R, Redbeard, LLD, so he's a lawyer, University of C, I don't know what that is. A reprint of the 1910 edition, London. Edited by Katya Lane, illustrated by Ron McVan. So this is one issue that David Lane's people had prepared. Cover art, Alexander the Great, Teutonic Berserker, General Patton. Exclusive, Millennial Wotans Folk Edition, 1999. Is what the PDF I'm reading from is made of. Picture of a guy. We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. A quote from David Lane, 14 words, which is basically adapted from the National Socialists in Germany, which a lot of people don't seem to know or acknowledge. 14 word press, HCO1, box 268K, St. Mary's, Idaho, 83861, USA. I'm sure that is probably very, very out of date. I'm just reading it for the record. Copyright 1999, 14 word press. Now, we begin with a couple of epigraphs and then the table of contents. The law, immutable, indestructible, eternal, not like those of today and yesterday, but made ere time began. Sophocles, the law immutable. Must we then speak of this subject also? And shall we write concerning things that are not to be told? And shall we publish things not to be divulged? And secrets not to be spoken aloud? Julian the Emperor is the second epigraph. There's a design of a Viking with a horned helmet, whether they wore that or not. Table of contents for Might is Right. And again, we're going to do Chapter 1 and all material preceding it. There's an editor's note, preface, preview, poems and pieces, and then Chapter 1, which is called introductory. So, I don't know if that's the way Katya Lane said it or the way it was originally, but this book has been around a good long time. We don't need to read the chapters out, but well, I guess we could. Chapter 1, Introductory. The living forces of evil are to be found in the moral ideal, capital M and I, of today. Chapter 2, Iconoclastic. Christian ethics impeached. Jesus, the true prince of evil. Mephistopheles of the world, king of slaves. Chapter 3, The spinning of the web. The ship of state, a pirate ship. All men created equal is the strident doctrine of the maniac. Chapter 4, Man the Carnivore, the ideal animal, a destructive warrior, not a crucified carpenter. Moral principles are slave regulations. Chapter 5, The chief end of manhood, material success. Self-preservation, the first law of nature. Hell takes the defeated ones, the failures. Chapter 6, Love and women in war. Female animals love the best fighting males. Sexual selection and the necessity of unmerciful conflict. So that's what this book is all about, and we're going to do Chapter 1, but before that, we have Editor's Note, Preface. A title like Might is Right is almost precludes the necessity of an introduction, since all history, natural law, and common sense declare its truth. The author of this epic manifesto remains an enigmatic issue. As most of history is merely the propaganda of the victor, in quotes, we shall never be certain of many details. Due to the nature of Might is Right and the brutal truth of its dynamic pronunciamentos, it has never before been published with a critical eye of a major publishing house. It appears that the raw text of the original, with additions, has been meticulously preserved in a near unadulterated form. 14 Word Press is honored to present here for Wotan's folk worldwide this exclusive millennial edition, remember 1999. For the first time since its original release a century ago, Might is Right has now been published with particular and much-deserved scrutiny to detail, leaving the 1910 text nearly unaltered. Having had the task and privilege of editing this powerful piece, the arcane evidence of authorship in the work itself became quite apparent. Ragnar Redbeard indeed ranks with Nietzsche, if he himself was not the initial author, as an intelligent and erudite thinker and writer. Many believe that Jack London was Ragnar Redbeard. Nevertheless, the literary styles reveal unequivocally that Might is Right had at least two distinct authors. The original, Redbeard, wrote in a clean, technical style, consistent and methodical. In fact, it is very possibly the product of a skilled translator who retained many of the uppercase nouns and punctuation typical of the German language. In German, the nouns are capitalized. It used to be the case in English hundreds of years ago, but is not today. The entire text is laced with numerous foreign phrases and translations. However, interspersed throughout this treatise are sentences, often whole paragraphs, of passionate commentary expounding upon and contrasted to the near clinical approach of Ragnar Redbeard. It seems convincingly clear that these complementary addenda were authored by Jack London, a brilliant creative talent, naturalist, lucid visionary, and exceptional philosopher with an incandescent imagination. Solely on a grammatical basis, this is an airtight conclusion. London, a purely artistic genius, had no regard for standard punctuation or sentence structure. His personal writing style was as idiosyncratic as his trademark passion was pronounced. The poorly punctuated, verbose, adjectival outpourings of abundant vocabulary and run-on sentences are unmistakably London. Aside from London-esque writing style and philosophy, the fact that some claim to have seen portions of the Might is Right manuscript in London's own hand lends credence to this theory. A careful reader will instinctively sense the temperamental roller coaster created by the blend of these markedly distinct writers as the cultural references swing back and forth between European and American orthography, colloquialisms, orthography is spelling, colloquialisms, syntax, and historical perspectives. And just as Jack London was infectiously enticed, it is assured that the reader will have his own personal, emotional, and eloquent reaction to the illuminisms apotheosized herein. Regardless of the true identity of the authors, truth is indisputable. Truth is its own author. Some have criticized this iconoclastic masterpiece for advocating anarchy. The fact that we might perceive the ruthless cruelty of nature as chaos does not change our reality. Man and all his laws are subject to the mercilessly indomitable law of nature, or laws of nature. Our racial survival depends on Aryan man rediscovering his nature-ordained manhood. He must choose between cowardice and courage, between comfort and freedom, between extinction and a future for white children. There is no compromise. Victory sanctifies. Nature rules. And that's Katya Lane, 20 May 1999. The interlocking triangles symbol. As an editor and publisher with 14 Word Press, Katya, Mrs. David Lane, supports her husband's political struggle and distributes his writings. Mr. Lane is a political prisoner serving 190 years in the United States Federal Penitentiary for alleged, quote, civil rights violations. The daughter of an MIA pilot in Vietnam, missing in action, Katya spent over 30 years, quote, seeking truth where tyrants would deny it, unquote, David Lane died in prison. Katya Lane, I don't know if she's still alive or not, but I have not heard anything. She was a big name when I came into the movement right around the turn of the millennium, around 2000, right when a year after this came out. But I was reading upon it before then. So that was her preface, her editor's note. Preview. Might is right. Poems and pieces. This is some stuff to kind of get you in the mood for the text that will follow. The logic of today. Some quotes and some poetry. Inferior organisms succumb and perish or are enslaved. Superior organisms survive, propagate, and possess. That's Darwin. All men are created equal is an infernal lie. Not by speechifying and majority votes can the great questions of today be settled, but by iron and blood. And that's Bismarck. Pax vobiscum. Fill high your vaults with booty. Bid evolution cease. And chant Belshazzar's anthem. O Baal, preserve the peace. The logic of today. And this is a longer sort of a poem. The logic of today. Might was right when Caesar bled upon the stones of Rome. Might was right when Joshua led his hordes o'er Jordan's foam. And might was right when German troops poured down through Paris gay. It's the gospel of the ancient world and the logic of today. Behind all kings and presidents, all government and law, our army corps and cannoneers to hold the world in awe, and sword-strong races own the earth and ride the conqueror's car, and liberty has ne'er been won except by deeds of war. What are the lords of hoarded gold, the silent Semite rings? What are the plunder patriots, high pontiffs, priests, and kings? What are they but bold masterminds best fitted for the fray, who comprehend and vanquish by the logic of today? Cain's knotted club is scepter still. The rights of man is fraud. Christ's ethics are for creeping things. True manhood smiles at God. God in quotes. For might is right when empires sick in storms of steel and flame. And it is right when weakling breeds are hunted down like game. Then what's the use of dreaming dreams that each shall get his own? Quote. By forceless votes of meek-eyed thralls who blindly sweat and moan. No, a curse is on their cankered brains, their very bones decay. Go, trace your fate in the iron game, is the logic of today. The strong must ever rule the weak, is grim primordial law. On earth's broad racial threshing floor, the meek are beaten straw. Then ride to power o'er foeman's neck, let nothing bar your way. If you are fit, you'll rule and reign, is the logic of today. You must prove your right by deeds of might, of splendor and renown. If need be, march through flames of hell to dash opponents down. If need be, die on scaffold high in the morning misty gray, for liberty or death is still the logic of today. Might was right when Gideon led the chosen tribes of old, chosen in quotes, and it was right when Titus burnt their temple roofed with gold, and might was right from Bunker's Hill to far Manila Bay. By land and flood, it's wrote in blood, the gospel of today. Put not your trust in princes, is a saying old and true. Put not your hope in governments, translateth it anew. All books of law and golden rules are fashioned to betray. The survival of the strongest is the gospel of today. Might was right when Carthage flames lit up the Punic foam, and when the naked steel of Gaul weighed down the spoil of Rome. And might was right when Richmond fell and at Thermopylae. It's the logic of the ancient world and the gospel of today. Where pendant suns in millions swing around this whirling earth, it's might, it's force that holds the brakes and steers through life and death. Force governs all organic life, inspires right and wrong. It's nature's plan to weed out man and test who are the strong. And that's the end of that poem. Next, opportunities. A man's opportunities are never exhausted so long as other men, who are not his friends, possess millions of acres and thousands of tons of gold. The guarded treasure halls and ironclad temples of modern kings and presidents, high priests and millionaires are positively the richest the world has ever known. Bulging are they with vast hoards of silver and diamonds and gold. Here, then, is opportunity on a colossal scale. Here is the goal of Caesars, Nebuchadnezzars, and Napoleons in the days that are coming. All is ready and prepared for them, even as in olden times. Caesar carried off the treasures of Egypt, Greece, Gaul, and Rome. Napoleon looted the money vaults of Venice, Vienna, Madrid, Berlin, and Moscow. London only escaped him. Nebuchadnezzar plundered the Temple of Zion, where the Jews kept all their deposits, and drank his beer and wine out of Jehovah's pots of gold. Napoleon, Caesar, Nebuchadnezzar. There were three great men, were they not? And in this, their greatness consisted. They seized their opportunities. Another poem now, The Higher Law. From Sandy Hook to London Tower, from Jaffa to Japan, they can take who have the power, they may keep who can. This is the law of heaven and hell, stupendous and divine, the highest, holiest law of all, that governs mine and thine. The law it is of sun and star, of president and pope. It is the prisoner at the bar, the gallows and the rope. It is the lawyer and his fee, the shearer and his sheep, the eagle soaring swift and free, the dreadnought on the deep. It is the bond, it is the loan, the profit and the loss, the usurer on his bullion throne, the idol of the cross. It is the Goth, it is the Hun, the tyrant and his prey, and flame and saber, club and gun, oh, taxes that we pay. It is the law of all the climes and all the things to be, and all the bold, tremendous times that you and I shall see. From Sandy Hook to London Tower, from Greenland to Japan, they will take who have the power, and they may keep who can. That's attributed to Redbeard's Review. And then there's a graphic of a sort of Viking, or in some other ways heroic type, with a sword clutched in both of his hands, one on the blade above his head, with reads 14 words in the side of the slave and the flat of it. And then the text accompanying it, again with the Celtic cross and then the three triangle symbol. Just as fear is contagious, likewise is courage and chivalry. He who fears death will never do anything worthy of a living man, kinsman. If your folk and heritage are not worth fighting for, then I ask you, what is? The victor gets the gold is the next chunk. Virtue is rewarded in this world, remember. Natural law makes no false judgments. Its decisions are true and just, even when dreadful. The victor gets the gold and the land every time. He also gets the fairest maidens, the glory tributes. And why should it be otherwise? Why should the delights of life go to failures and cowards? Why should the spoils of battle belong to the unwarlike? That would be insanity, utterly unnatural and immoral. Next, and I believe final, before we get on to chapter 1 proper, all else is error. The natural world is a world of war. The natural man is a warrior. The natural law is tooth and claw. All else is error. A condition of combat everywhere exists. We are born into perpetual conflict. It is our inheritance, even as it was the heritage of previous generations. This condition of combat may be disguised with the holy phrases of St. Francis or the soft, deceitful doctrines of a Kropotkin or Tolstoy, but it cannot be eventually evaded by any human being or any tribe of human beings. It is there, and it stays there, and each man, whether he will or not, has to reckon with it. It rules all things, it governs all things, it reigns over all things, and it decides all who imagine policemanized population, internationally regulated tranquility, and the state-organized industrialism so joyful, blessed, and divine. Behold the crucifix. What does it symbolize? Pallid incompetence hanging on a tree. Lo, I hear the fighters coming over hill and dale and plain, with battle cry of ages in a rebel world again, who'd forge their swords to plowshares, shall sweat in bitter yokes, the freeborn race and fearless must deal out battle strokes. Two stanzas. In the wars of the great Caesar and grim Hannibal, in the times of Belcazar, the pharaohs and all, the days of Rienzi and Roland the Bold, all banners were waving for women and gold. It is might against might, remember, by land and sea, man against man, money against money, brains against brains, and everything to the winner. And now we get to chapter one proper. Might is right, chapter one. In this arid wilderness of steel and stone, I raise up my voice that you may hear. To the east and to the west I beckon, to the north and to the south I show a sign, proclaiming death to the weakling, wealth to the strong. Open your eyes that you may hear, O men of mildewed minds, and listen to me, ye laborious millions. For I stand forth to challenge the wisdom of the world, to interrogate the, quote, laws of man and of, quote, God. I request the reasons for your golden rule, and I ask the why and wherefore of your Ten Commandments, or Ten Commands. Before none of your printed idols do I bend in acquiescence, and he who saith, Thou shalt, to me is my mortal foe. I demand proof over all things, and accept, with reservations, even that which is true. I dip my forefinger in the watery blood of your impotent mad redeemer, your divine democrat, your Hebrew madman, and write over his thorn-torn brow, the true prince of evil, the king of the slaves. No hoary falsehood shall be a truth to me. No cult or dogma shall encamp my pen. I break away from all conventions. Alone, untrammeled, I raise up in stern invasion the standard of strong. I gaze into the glassy eye of your fearsome Jehovah and pluck him by the beard. I uplift a broad axe and split open his worm-eaten skull. I blast out the ghastly contents of philosophic whited sepulchres and laugh with sardonic wrath. Then, reaching upon the festering and varnished facades of your haughtiest moral dogmas, I write thereon, in letters of blazing scorn, Lo and behold, all this is fraud. I deny all things, I question all things, and yet, gather around me, O ye death-defiant, and the earth itself shall be thine to have and to hold. What is your civilization and progress if its only outcome is hysteria and downgoing? What is government and law if their ripened harvests are men without sap? What are religions and literatures if their grandest productions are hordes of faithful slaves? What is evolution and culture if their Dead Sea fruit is a caitiff race with rottenness in its bones? 2, a new subsection. Or actually, that's just a page number. How is it that men of light and leading hardly ever call in question the manufactured moral codes under which our once vigorous northern race is slowly and surely eating out its heart in peaceful inaction and laborious dry rot? Standard moral principles, in tweezers, are arbitrarily assumed by their orthodox apologists to be a fixed and unalterable quantity, and that to doubt the divine rightness of these principles is treason and sacrilege. When the greatest thinkers of a race are incapable or afraid to perform their manifest and logical function, it is scarcely to be wondered that average citizens are, also, somewhat unwilling to risk life, fortune, and sacred honor for the overthrow of popularized right and wrong concepts that they know from bitter personal experience are unworkable falsities. Although the average man feels in his heart that nearly all political and religious conventionalisms are dynamic deceits, yet how cautiously he avoids any open display of antagonism thereto. He has not the courage of his opinions. He is afraid to say openly what he thinks secretly. In other words, he is living in a state of subjectiveness, of vassalage. He allows his brain to be dominated and held in bondage by the brain of another. From his infancy, he has been deliberately subjected to a continuous external pressure, especially designed to coerce his understanding into strict accord with prearranged views of moral, political, or religious duty. He has not been permitted one moment of real mental liberty. He imbibed fraudulent conventionalisms with his mother's milk. He listens to the most hideous lies being glorified in his presence as sublime truths. He hears falsehoods sung in swelling chorus. He hears them sounded on bugles of silver and brass. He hears them intoned by congregations of the faithful amid peals of sacred music and the solemn roll of chanted prayer. Thus his mind is sterilized by authority before it has a chance to mature. Thus youth is mentally castrated, that its natural vitality may be afterwards used up in the yoke of custom, which is the yoke of slavery. In the nursery, at school, and at college, plastic brain pulp is deliberately forced into the prearranged mold. Everything that a corrupt civilization can do is done to compress the growing intellect into unnatural channels. Thus, the great mass of men who inhabit the world of today have no initiative, no originality or independence of thought, but are mere subjective individualities who have never had the slightest voice in fashioning the ideals they formerly revere. Pause just briefly to note, this is in the period after Nietzsche and his philosophy, and also when you had really the formation and widespreading of public schools to turn out cogs. So all this fits together, and if this is published around 1910, this is some of the stuff that the person writing it would be seeing and would be knowing about and reading that would inform his view. Although the average man has taken no part in manufacturing moral codes and statute laws, yet how he obeys them with a dog-like submissiveness. He is trained to obedience, like oxen are broken to the yoke of their masters. He is a born thrall, habituated from childhood to be governed by others. Chinese civilization deliberately distorts its children's feet by swathing them in bandages of silk and hoop iron. Christian civilization crushes and cramps the mind of its youth by means of false philosophies, artificial moral codes, and ironclad political creeds. Deleterious sub-theories of good and evil are systematically injected into our national literatures, and gradually, without serious obstruction, they crystallize themselves into cast-iron formulas, infallible constitutions, will-o'-the-wisp evangels, and other deadly epidemics. Modern leaders of thought are almost wholly wanting in originality and courage. Their wisdom is foolishness, their remedies poison. They idiotically claim that they guide the destinies of nations, whereas, in reality, they are but the flotsam and scum froth that glides smoothly down the dark stream of decadence. Quote, thus all the people of the earth are helpless, seeing those that lead are blind. Mankind is aweary of its sham prophets, its demagogues, and its statesmen. It cries out for kings and heroes. It demands a nobility. A nobility that cannot be hired with money, like slaves or beasts of burden. The world awaits the coming of mighty men of valor, great destroyers, destroyers of all that is vile, angels of death. We are sick unto nausea of the good Lord Jesus, terror-stricken under the executive of priest, mob, and proconsul. We are tired to death of equality. Gods are at a discount. Devils are in demand. He who would rule the coming age must be hard, cruel, and deliberately intrepid, for softness assails not successfully the idols of the multitude. Those idols must be smashed into fragments, burnt into ashes, and that cannot be done by the gospel of love. The living forces of evil are to be found in the living ideals of today. The commandments and laws and moral codes that we are called upon to reverence and obey are themselves the insidious enginery of decadence. It is moral principles that manufacture beggars. It is golden rules that glorify meekness. It is statute laws that make spaniels of men. A man may keep every one of the Ten Commandments and yet remain a fool all the days of his life. He may obey every written law of the land and yet be a caitiff and a slave. He may love Jesus, delight in the golden rule, and yet continue to the hour of his death, a failure and dependent. Truly, the way to hell is by fulfilling the commandments of God. If the all wrong, is not to irretrievably dwindle into multitudinous nothingness, like the inferior herds it has outdistanced or enslaved, then it is essential that the Semitic spider webs, so astutely woven for ages into the brains of our chiefs, be remorselessly torn out by the very roots, even though the tearing out process be both painful and bloody. If we would retain and defend our inherited manhood, we must not permit ourselves to be forever rocked to repose with the sweet lullabies of Eastern idealisms. Too long we have been hypnotized by the occult charm of Hebrew utopianism. If we continue to obey the insidious spell that has been laid upon us, we will wake up some dread morning with the gates of hell upon earth, yawning wide open to close again upon us forever. The idea of hell is in some respects a truthful conception, suggestive of actual fact. If we terrestrialize the location, there is nothing inharmonious about it. Many a race, many a tribe, and many a mighty empire has gone down into a grimly realistic Sheol, which is hell. It is not right and just that the vile, the base, and the degenerate, that is to say, the slave nations of the earth, should be punished pitilessly. Is it not right and just that the vile, the base, and the degenerate, that is to say, the slave nations of the earth, should be punished pitilessly for their creeping cowardice? Is it not right that they should be, as it were, fried and roasted, should swim in pools of boiling blood, or dance sweltering satanic glees with blistering feet and straining eyeballs on red-hot Saharas of gravel and sand? In actual operation, nature is cruel and merciless to men, as to all other beings. Let a tribe of human animals live a rational life, nature will smile upon them and their posterity, but let them attempt to organize an unnatural mode of existence, an equality Elysium, and thy will be punished, even to the point of extermination. All ethics, politics, and philosophies are pure assumptions, built on assumptions. They rest on no sure basis. They are but shadowy castles in the air, erected by daydreamers or by rogues upon nursery fables. It is time they were firmly planted upon an enduring foundation. This can never be accomplished until the racial mind has first been thoroughly cleansed and drastically disinfected of its depraved, alien, and demoralizing concepts of right and wrong. In no human brain can sufficient space be found for the relentless logic of hard fact until all pre-existent delusions have been finally annihilated. Half measures are of no avail. We must go down to the very roots and tear them out, even to the last fiber. We must be, like nature, hard, cruel, and relentless. Too long the dead hand has been permitted to sterilize living thought. Too long. Right and wrong, good and evil, have been inverted by false prophets. In the days that are at hand, neither creed nor code must be accepted upon authority, human, superhuman, or divine. Morality and conventionalism are for subordinates. Religions and constitutions and all arbitrary principles, every mortal theorem, must be deliberately put to the question. No moral dogma must be taken for granted. No standard measure deified. There is nothing inherently sacred about moral codes. Like the wooden idols of long ago, they are all the work of human hands, and what man has made, man can destroy. He that is slow to believe anything and everything is of great understanding, for belief in one false principle is the beginning of all unwisdom. The chief duty of every new age is to upraise new men to determine its liberties, to lead it towards material success, to rend, as it were, the rusty padlocks and chains of dead custom that always prevent healthy expansion. Theories and ideals and constitutions that may have meant life and hope and freedom for our ancestors may now mean destruction, slavery, and dishonor to us. As environments change, no human ideal can standeth sure. Wherever, therefore, lie has built unto itself a throne, let it be assailed without pity and without regret, for under the domination of a falsehood, no nation can permanently prosper. Let established sophisms be dethroned, rooted out, burnt, and destroyed. for they are a standing menace to all true nobility of thought and action. Whatever alleged truth is proven by results to be but an empty fiction, let it be unceremoniously flung into the outer darkness, among the dead gods, dead empires, dead philosophies, and other useless lumber and wreckage. The most dangerous of all enthroned lies is the holy, the sanctified, the privileged lie, the lie that everybody, quote-unquote, believes to be a model truth. It is the fruitful mother of all other popular errors and delusions. It is Hydra-headed. It has 1,000 roots. It is a social cancer. The lie that is known to be a lie is half eradicated, but the lie that even intelligent persons regard as a sacred fact, the lie that has been inculcated around a mother's knee, is more dangerous to contend against than a creeping pestilence. Popular lies have ever been the most potent enemies of personal liberty. There is only one way to deal with them. Cut them out, to the very core, just as cancers are. Exterminate them, root and branch, or they will surely eat us all up. We must annihilate them, or they will us. Half and half remedies are of no avail. However, when a lie has gone too far, when it has taken up its abode in the very tissues, bones, and brains of a people, then all remedies are useless. Even the Lancet is of no avail. Repentance of past misdeeds cannot save decadence from extermination. The fatal bolt is shot, and into the fiery furnace of wholesale slavery and oblivion they must go, to be there righteously consumed. From their ashes, something new, something nobler, may possibly evolve, but even that is the merest optimistic supposition. In nature, the wages of sin is always death. Nature does not love the wrongdoer, but endeavors in every possible way to destroy him. Her curse is on the brow of the meek and lowly. Her blessing is on the very heart's blood of the strong and the brave. Only Jews and Christians and other degenerates think that rejuvenation can ever come through law and prayer. All the tears of the martyrs, quote, might just as well never been shed. Whatsoever a people believeth shall make it free, enslave it, or corrode its very marrow in strict accordance with natural order. Consequently, if a people place implicit faith in what philosophers teach them, they are liable to be duped. If many nations are so duped, their deception is a menace to the liberty of the world. Free men should never regulate their conduct by the suggestions or dicta of others, for when they do so, they are no longer free. No man ought to obey any contract, written or implied, except he himself has given his personal and formal adherence thereto, when in a state of mental maturity and unrestrained liberty. It is only slaves that are born into contracts, signed and sealed by their progenitors. The freeman is born free, lives free, and dies free. He is, even though living in an artificial civilization, above all laws, all constitutions, all theories of right and wrong. He supports and defends them, of course, as long as they suit his own end, but if they don't, then he annihilates them by the easiest and most direct method. There is no obligation upon any man to passive obedience when his life, his liberty, and his property are threatened by footpad, assassins, or statesmen. One of Columbus's lieutenants in the West Indies captured a Carib chief by means of a subtle stratagem. Chief was invited to a feast, and when there, persuaded with honeyed words to don, on horseback, a set of brightly polished steel manacles, it being cunningly represented to him that the irons were the regalia of sovereignty. He foolishly believed his astute flatterer, and when the chains were firmly clasped around his limbs, he was led away to die of vermin, turning a mill in a Spanish dungeon. What those glittering manacles were to the Indian chieftain, constitutions, laws, moral codes, and Hebrew-dominated civilizations are to the nations of the earth. Indeed, under the name of progress and social evolution, mankind has been lured into fetid dungeons where it labors unceasingly and for naught in darkness, despair, and shame. Like the Spanish lieutenant, the masters of the earth first flatter their dupes in order to more easily enchain them. Who talks nowadays of the sovereign people without a laugh of derision? And yet it was once thought to be a term full of significance. Their sovereignty is now an acknowledged sham, and their freedom a dream. The sovereign people be damned. It is clear, therefore, that the man or nation that would retain liberty, or be really safe, must accept no formula as final, must trust in nothing written or unwritten, living or dead, must believe neither in special Jehovahs, nor weeping saviors, neither in raging devils, nor in devilish philosophies, neither in ghosts, nor in idols, nor in laws, nor in woman, nor in man. Now indented posy. O threats of hell and hopes of paradise, one thing at least is certain, this life flies. One thing is certain, and all the rest is, the flower that once has bloomed forever dies. He who saith unto himself, I must believe, I must not question, is not a man, but a mere pusillanimous mental gelding. He who believes, because it has been handed down, is a menial in his heart. And he who believes, because it has been written, is a fool in his folly. Sagacious spirits doubt all things, and hold fast only to that which is demonstrably true. The rules of life are not to be found in Korans, Bibles, Decalogues, and Constitutions, but rather the rules of decadence and death. The law of laws is not written in Hebrew consonants or upon tables of brass and stone, but in every man's own heart. He who obeys any standard of right and wrong but the one set up by his own conscience betrays himself into the hands of his enemies, who are ever laying in wait to bind him to their millstones. And generally a man's most dangerous enemies are his neighbors. Masterful men laugh with contempt at spiritual thunders and have no occasion to dread the decisions of any human tribunal. They are above and beyond all that. Laws and regulations are only for conquered vassals. The free man does not require them. He may manufacture and post up Decalogue regulations to bind and control dependents with, but he does not himself bow down before those inventions with his own hands, except as a lure. Statute books and golden rules were made to fetter slaves and fools. Very useful are they for controlling the herds of sentenced convicts who filled the factories and cultivated the fields. All moral principles, therefore, are the servitors, not the masters of the strong. Power made moral codes, and power abrogates them. A man is under no obligation to obey anything or anybody. It is only serving men that must obey, because they are caitiffs by birth, breeding, and condition. Morals are only required in an immoral community, that is to say, a community held in a state of conquest. Fear God, bridle the spirit, and obey the law is advice most excellent as from a philosopher to a yokel, but when directed in all earnestness at a man of inherent might, he smiles to himself in silent scorn. Full well he knows that in actual life the path to victory and renown does not lie through Gethsemanes, but over fallen enemies, the ruins of rival combines, through Aceldamas. Meekness of spirit is regarded by him as a convenient superstition, very useful for regulating the lives of his servants, his women, and his children, but otherwise inoperative. I rest my hopes on nothing, proclaimed Goethe, and masterful minds in all ages have never done otherwise. This unspoken thought gives to all truly great men their manifest superiority over the brainless vociferating herd. The common people have always had to be fooled with some written or wooden or golden idol, some constitution, declaration, or gospel. Consequently, the majority of them have ever been mental thralls, living and dying in an atmosphere of strong illusion. They are befooled and hypnotized even to this hour, and a large proportion of them must remain so until time is no more. Indeed, the masses of mankind are but the sediment from which all the more valuable elements have long ago been distilled. They are totally incapable of real freedom, and if it were granted to them, they would straightway vote themselves a master, or 1,000 masters, within 24 hours. Mastership is right. Mastership is natural. Mastership is eternal. but only for those who cannot overthrow it and trample it beneath their hoofs. Is it not a fact that in actual life the ballot box votes of 10 million subjective personalities are as thistle down in the balance when weighed against the far-seeing thought and material prowess of, say, 10 strong silent men? It is notorious, universally so, that the blackest falsehoods are ever decked out in the most brilliant and gorgeous regalia. Clearly, therefore, it is the brave man's duty to regard all sacred things, all legal things, all constitutional things, all holy things, with more than usual suspicion. I deny and I affirm is the countersign of material freedom. I believe and I obey is the shibboleth of serfage. Belief is a flunky, a feminine. Doubt is a creator, a master. He who denies fundamentals in triple armor clad is in triple armor clad. Indeed, he is invulnerable. On the other hand, it has been said that every belief, every philosophy has some truth in it, but so, we might add, has every insanity. Strong men are not deterred from pursuing their aim by anything. They go straight to the goal, and that goal is beauty, wealth, material power. The mission of power is to control and exploit the powerless, for to be powerless is to be criminal. The world would indeed be a house of horrors if all men were good and all women padlocked. As far as human searchlights have yet penetrated into the darkness that enshrouds the origin of nations, we see the subduers to the subdued, the plebeians and the patricians, the chiefs who governed and the vassals who obeyed. And there is nothing in the most modern social developments of these deedless days to warrant any belief that this ancient and natural division of human animals into castes of superiors and inferiors, sovereigns and serfs, can ever be dispensed with. The slave owner's whip cracked from the beginning, and it will crack till the day of doom. In every kingdom, republic, and empire on earth, we have, in one disguise or another, the master and the slave, the ruler and the ruled. In the course of centuries, names alone have changed, essentials have remained the same. Form of royalty may alter, but kings can never die. There was mastership at the beginning, and there will be mastership at the end. We build, but as our fathers built. Change is not progress, nor numbers advance. Everyone who would be free must show his power. Unalterable remains the basis. He who exalteth himself shall be exalted, and he who humbleth himself shall be righteously trodden beneath the hoofs of the herd. The humble are only fit for dog's meat. Bravery includes every virtue, humility every crime. He who is afraid to risk his life must never be permitted to win. Human rights and wrongs are not determined by justice, but by might. Disguise it as you may, the naked sword is still kingmaker and kingbreaker as of yore. All other theories are lies and lures. Therefore, if you would conquer wealth and power, wealth and honor, power and fame, you must be practical, grim, cool, and merciless. You must ride to success, by preference, over the necks of your foemen. Their defeat is your strength. Their downfall is your uplifting. Only the powerful can be free, and power is non-moral. Life is real, life is earnest, and neither heaven nor hell is its final goal. And love, and joy, and birth, and death, and fate, and strife shall be forever. The earth is a vast whirl of warring atoms, a veritable revolving cockpit. Each molecule, each animal, fights for its life, and you must fight for yours, or surrender. Look well to it, therefore, that your beaks and spurs, your fangs and claws are as sharp as steel, and as effective as science can make them. Though the survival of the strongest is the logic of events, yet personal cowardice is the great vice of our demoralized age. Cowardice is corroding the brain and blood of our race, but men have learnt to disguise this terrible infirmity behind the canting whine of humanity and goodness. Words flow instead of blood, and terrible insults are exchanged instead of terrible blows. How rich this degenerate world is in small, petty-souled good-for-nothings who are forever excusing their infantile ineptitude behind some plausible phrase, some conventional make-believe. Courage, I say. Courage, not goodness, is the great desideratum. Courage that requires neither tin horns, nor calcium lights, nor brass bands, nor shouting multitudes to call it into effective action. But courage that goes its way alone, as undauntedly as when it marches to victory or death amid the menacing stride of armed and bannered legions. Well, it's a very different way of looking at the world from anything you will hear in any public institution or from any publicly proclaimed speaker or elected official, wouldn't you say? You won't hear that in any Sunday school. You won't hear that in any Monday school. You won't hear that from any politician. But think about it. Kick it with your mind's foot and see if it breaks. And that will conclude our first segment of Might is Right by Ragnar Redbeard from back in 2010, edited and laid out by Katya Lane. Thanks for being with me today. You can find everything that we record at vnnforum.com. I'll be back with you again real soon.